This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon, and welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. Today and next week will be a two-part program on child abuse. It's the first time we've really – that's not true. We did a two-part program on legal euthanasia, doctors helping patients commit suicide in Oregon at one time, although they weren't back-to-back like this program. I thought this was a big enough issue and an important enough issue to try to do that. And with me today, we have Dr. Laura Jones, who is a clinical child psychologist, child and adolescent psychologist here in Anchorage. June Haston, who is a coordinator with the CASA program, which we'll learn more about in a little bit. And Amanda Mativier, who is the founder of an organization called Facing Foster Care in Alaska. And we'll also ask her, in addition, to describe what that organization is all about. Before we get much further, I always like to talk about definitions. It's the science part of me, so that we all know what we're talking about. And this is one, Laura, I would think is not so easy to define. But what are we talking about when we start talking about child abuse and neglect? And are those the proper terms anyway?
I prefer at this point the term child maltreatment. And child maltreatment has been defined by a whole lot of different organizations to try to be more specific, but it is things that people do or fail to do that result in putting a child at risk for injury. Child abuse are usually things that are done to kids, hitting, spanking excessively, in other ways injuring them. Child sexual abuse involves sexual acts committed on children, including photographs. And neglect involves those acts of omission, not properly caring for a child. And many people are surprised to find out that the vast majority of reports for child maltreatment across the nation are for neglect and not for things that are done to kids, but not providing appropriate care.
Okay. And before I proceed to kind of talk about this a little bit more, I would like to take just a brief second to alert our listeners that this program may have some content that may be offensive to some individuals, and that parents should use some guidance on having particularly children listen to this particular program. So keep aware about that. And while I'm doing that, if you have questions or comments as listeners or experiences you'd like to share with us, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email me between now and 3 o'clock Anchorage time at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. You can listen to the program again tonight at 8 o'clock, but that's a taped rebroadcast. So how much of a problem is it? What do we know about nationally, locally? How many kids are involved? Is it increasing, decreasing? You know, put some frame of reference on this program.
I have some data from 2006, and in 2006, nationally, 6 million kids were referred for reports of possible child abuse or child neglect. Of those referrals, a little more than half, about 3.5 million of the children were found to have substantiated reports of abuse or neglect. And of those, about 900,000 were serious enough to require intervention. So that's national numbers. In 2006 in Alaska, there were about 10,000 referrals. Again, a little over half, 5,700 or so, were referred for investigation, and about 3,400 of those kids were found to have substantiated having been abused or neglected.
I guess the next question that comes to my mind, and I'll open this up to anybody who wants the answer, is how do children get into the system? How do they get reported? And then I'm interested in what happens next once that report is made.
Well, I In terms of being, anyone can make a report of harm. Anyone can call the Office of Children's Services, and their reporting number is 269-4000, and say that they have a concern about a child's safety, whether or not, and then they can let the person answering the phone know what the issue is, what the concern is, and then the Office of Children's Services decides whether or not they're going to, whether that does warrant a report of harm and an investigation, and then they determine whether or not that report of harm is, as Laura Jones said, substantiated or not. And just because the report of harm could be substantiated doesn't necessarily mean that the department does take legal custody. They don't necessarily take legal custody every time. They may work informally with family.
And how does the whole issue get into the court system then from that point of view? I'm trying to drag you in as the being the guardian ad litem and to talk about CASA. So I wanted to how do we get into the court system? How does CASA get involved? What is CASA? What's a guardian ad litem?
Well, when the Office of Children's Services files a petition or goes into court and asks for custody of children or youth, then our office, the Office of Public Advocacy, is appointed by the courts to represent the best interest of the child. And our agency then assigns a guardian ad litem to that case. And then through the CASA program, which is where I work, and CASA stands for, it's CASA, standing for Court-Appointed Special Advocate, then we review all the petitions that come in, all the new cases that come in, and make a determination of whether or not we think that that case should have a CASA on it. And CASA stands for Volunteer Guardian Ad Litem. We have a grant through the National CASA Association, and almost every state has at least one, if not multiple CASA programs. It's a very wonderful program created by a judge, I believe, in the early 80s, who was hearing these child protection cases, and he was waking up at night kind of agonizing over what his decisions were going to be in terms of visitation for children with their parents, when they return home, when they don't return home, when parental rights should be terminated. And he was having a really tough time with that, and decided he was going to do a brown bag lunch and invite people from the community to come in and kind of brainstorm about how to help him make some recommendations. And he was shocked to find that a lot of people in the community were actually very interested. And so from there, the CASA program started. And so we recruit community members, and you don't have to have any kind of expertise or experience, just an interest in working with children and a commitment to work with a family for a period of time, the whole time that they're in care. And we train you, and you go through a screening process. We do background checks. We do check through Office of Children's Services and see if you've ever been involved with them. I mean, we need to make sure that our volunteers are going to be safe to be around children, and the children will be safe with them. And we train them, and they go out and do an independent investigation and get to know the youth or the children that they're involved with, and then they come back to the court and let the court know what that child's issues are and how we can work towards safely returning that child home.
So I'm envisioning in a court system, you've got the representative of a parent or parents and the judge and the child or children and this guardian ad litem, a CASA volunteer, who are representing only the best interests of the child.
Right. Right. They're not attorneys. They just represent the best interests of children, the guardian ad litem and the CASA.
Specific training for the guardian ad litems?
Yes, we do have specific trainings.
And your job is to really kind of investigate from the child's point of view what's been going on. Do you get into the psychological evaluations, the medical reports, the legal aspects of this stuff too?
Our role is to do an independent investigation of what the Office of Children's Services is doing. And so if that child is involved in counseling or has medical issues, then our responsibility is to go out and to talk to those individuals and get information about what their issues are, and then kind of craft a case plan that's going to be able to address those needs to make sure that the children's needs are being met while they're in the custody of the state.
And Amanda, one of the problems that a person might foresee that's never been involved or really thought about this system for a while is that there's really not much there from the child's point of view. And that's, I guess, part of the motivation for you to have gone out and started an organization for graduates, foster children who've graduated, to maybe feedback and help the system work a little bit better from the child's point of view as well?
Yeah, we started Facing Foster Care in Alaska back in 2003, and we're a statewide organization of what we call youth and alumni of the foster care system. So we have youth who are currently in foster care and those who have aged out between the ages of 15 and 24. And basically, we bring a voice to youth in custody and to those who have aged out to work toward child welfare foster care reform, because there's no one asking a child or asking a youth while they're in state custody, well, what's working for you, what's not working for you. There is no evaluation they get to fill out on how the system works for them. And so this brings a voice to young people. And we have been impacting policy and practice within OCS and child welfare on a statewide level. And we've even impacted some legislation. And so it's really given a voice to young people, because they don't have it. When you're in foster care, you don't really have a voice. You have all these appointments and you have all these people, your social worker, your GAL, everyone's sort of making decisions for you and not asking you what you want. And a lot of times there isn't really room for input from a young person in foster care.
The CASA volunteer, the guardian ad litem, didn't meet that need sufficiently?
Well, I think case by case, it really depends on on their communication with that child or with that youth and that family. But
And we didn't talk about the fact that the guardian ad litem may have a large caseload, which makes it more difficult, which is the advantage of having the volunteers, is the guardian ad litem then help distribute cases to the CASA volunteers to get into more depth with some of the situations? Or?
Well, a guardian ad litem typically has anywhere from 90 to 100 youth that they are advocating for. And when we assign a CASA to a case, they're working with just that family. And it's usually a group of siblings. We generally assign CASAs to when there's more than one child in the home, because there's generally going to be multiple issues. And we look at giving them more complicated cases. But I think besides having a guardian ad litem in the courtroom, it's really important to have youth in the courtroom too, because oftentimes when we go into court, if that youth isn't there, because the parents are there, the parents' attorney's there, the guardian ad litem's there, the social worker's there, the social worker's attorney, and the judge, but really what we're there about is we're there about the youth. And so I think they need to be there. Even though they have a CASA or a guardian ad litem, their voice needs to be heard, and the judge needs to see that this is really a person. This is a live person, and this is what we're talking about, is making sure that this child can return safely home. And I think if they're not there, it doesn't empower them to be their own voice, because while it's our job to be their voice, I think they need to be empowered to say to the judge, this is what I think is working and this is what I don't think is working and this is what I want. And I think it's more powerful when they're there and can speak for themselves and be part of, it's their life that we're talking about, so I think they do need to be a part of it.
Laura, as a psychologist who's practiced for a few years in Alaska, have you seen things improve from this, from the point of view of how the legal system and those that are trying to do the best for kids in foster care, has that improved significantly, you think?
I think there have been some areas of really nice growth and improvement, and I think there are some other areas that have not improved and perhaps have even gotten worse. The overall numbers are going down, which is a good sign. I think there is more public education about child maltreatment and ways to avoid it. I think the system we are working, and I work with June Haston on fairly regularly on training people on some of these kinds of questions. What does it mean to children to lose their attachments and their bonds in the community? What is in their psychological best interest, not just what's in the adults' rights or not rights to these children? I think we are better educated about these issues, but some of the message is still clearly not getting through, because we are seeing so many kids still coming into care, so many kids staying in care and aging out of care without ever having a permanent home or a permanent placement, and we're not figuring out good ways to meet all of those needs. And I would say that it's the adolescents who probably do have the toughest time, because it's hard to find a home that's really a good long-term permanent home for these older kids.
Is the system being used in Alaska kind of the trademark, the common system used in most states in the United States, and then I'm always interested in seeing how we are doing this compared to other countries, if anybody has some perspective. I don't know if you do have that perspective or not, but we've been comparing our healthcare system with other healthcare other countries, so I thought I'd ask the same question here. Any comments about how we compare with other states and other countries in this issue?
I think there's a general overall trend now and an understanding that we have done a disservice to the teenagers who have aged out of the system, that I think there's finally enough research to show that we've pretty much, when adolescents are in the custody of the state and they turn 18, okay, you're an adult and you're on your own. And I think we all know, as parents, that just because your child turns 18 years old, it doesn't mean that they're ready to be on their own, and they still need that support, not only financially, but they need the support of their family. And we have youth that are aging out of the system that have no support there. They have no one to fall back on. And oftentimes when young adults leave the home, they end up coming back for short periods of time when they lose their job or they're looking to find a new house or save up some money. They go back home and they have their family to support them during those tough times. And what I think the research has shown is that our youth are not afforded that same opportunity, that we're pretty much just they're aging out of the system, and then they're on their own.
Amanda, is that your experience?
Oh, yeah. We had a youth recently who deemed the term foster homeless, and I think this sort of, it begins in foster care and it crosses over to when they age out. So we have youth, older teens in foster care who are hard to place because people want smaller children or babies, and teenagers are obviously going to be more difficult because they're going through hormone changes and things like that. And so now we have teenagers who are being placed at Covenant House for long periods of time, or even actually being homeless. We had a young man in Juneau who lived in a tent his last 3 months in custody, and they called it a trial home visit in Juneau, where it rains all the time. So I think this crosses over to when they get out of custody and they go back to places like Covenant House, because we have a lot of youth who say, well, that's the only family I ever know. The staff there is always going to welcome me. They're always going to be there. They're always going to be the only people who I felt connected to. So we've really been advocating for people to foster those relationships with caring adults for the youth that are in care for when they age out, so they have a connection to a permanent adult who's going to be there. What if your car breaks down? Who do you call? Usually people might call their parents or an aunt or a friend or a family member, but our youth don't have that. And so what we're seeing is youth who literally get out of custody and have no one. At this point in time, we have some who actually come to my house just to eat because they can pay rent, but that's all they can pay at this point. So we've really been advocating for those mentorships to start while in care and cross over to when they get out of care. And we want those relationships to be with people who aren't state workers, because they can't do it all.
All right. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll come back. I'd like to talk about prevention a little bit. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection with KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is a travel advisory on Mount Readout volcano eruption from Alaska Airlines. Alaska Airlines has suspended flights in and out of Anchorage for the remainder of today following a series of volcanic eruptions at Mount Readout. As a safety precaution, all scheduled flights already en route to Anchorage will be diverted to Fairbanks International Airport until further notice. Alaska Airlines will reevaluate resuming service in Anchorage on Tuesday, March 31st, pending favorable weather reports. Again, due to Mount Readout volcano eruptions, Alaska Airlines has suspended flights in and out of Anchorage today for the remainder of today following the series of volcanic eruptions at Mount Readout. And as a safety precaution, all scheduled flights already en route to Anchorage will be diverted to Fairbanks International Airport until further notice. This is KSKA Anchorage.
And this is Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about child abuse, and we've been talking about how the system works to some degree, and like many things, at least medical, it's always cheaper to do some prevention. What puts children at risk of getting into the child maltreatment system, and then what can we do to prevent that? What are ideas that are being promoted to help?
One of the big risk factors, unfortunately, is poverty. Children who are in homes where there is poverty tend to be under more stressful. The parents are under greater stress, may have fewer resources, and often less education about appropriate parenting. Parental mental illness or substance abuse also greatly increase the risk of child abuse. The most frequent child maltreatment, again, is neglect. And one of the real concerns is that so many of our young parents are not getting appropriate education and training early about what do especially very young children need in terms of level of supervision, feeding, medical care.
Parenting, basic
parenting. And so many of the recommendations have to do with needing to do more about teaching parents how to parent.
You women got to go and learn how to deliver a baby, but no one tells you what to do with it after you got it.
Right, you're right. Exactly.
Where's the logic there? I'm sorry. I've been waiting for that one for a long time as a pediatrician. Go ahead.
No, but you're exactly right. You go to childbirth education class, but, oh, what do you do once you have that baby home?
Right.
And some of the incredibly sad cases that you hear about are very well-meaning parents who don't know how to mix a formula to the right percentages, and so they underfeed their babies, and babies are at risk for serious health complications or even death because nobody taught the parent how to mix the formula correctly or how to use the right kind of bottle and nipple combination. Also, sadly, children who have other medical conditions, who are born prematurely, who have colicky kinds of presentations are at greater risk for being abused because they are so demanding on parents, and parents may not have the training or the experience or the patience to deal with that. I think it's in Child Abuse Prevention Month, which is in April, always very important to talk about shaken baby syndrome. This is such a preventable problem. It occurs when a very frustrated adult takes a baby and literally shakes them in a moment of anger and distress, or pushes them down hard into a bed or onto a hard surface, causing significant brain damage and often death. And this is something that through education we should be able to prevent always. Just some very simple education about what babies' brains need in terms of levels of protection.
So the common denominator, or at least one that I heard there, was stress. Things that are bothering a family, increasing the stress within a family, drug and alcohol abuse, financial stress, social stress, marital
Absolutely.
Stress, difficult children. And sometimes kids bring their own temperaments, which can be demanding on a family as well. It's not always the family's responsible in a total sense, I like to think, at least.
Some kids are much more difficult to parent than other kids. And often the kids I see in my own practice are these kids who've been difficult from very early on, who cry a lot, who don't sleep in a consistent manner, who have high needs, and they do. They wear out parents, which puts the child then at greater risk for abuse or neglect.
When we talk about parenting and when we talk about the outcomes of foster care, I feel like I should make a comment of something I heard a neuroscientist again recently talk about. It puts things very succinctly for parents and for people involved with children, especially early in life, is that as we learn more and more about the nervous system, this guy said in a podcast, we've evolved a brain that is extremely good at learning. What our brain doesn't do very well is unlearn. And I'm sure as a psychologist, you understand that. But the point is parents, we're teaching kids not just how to play baseball, but how to interact with other individuals. We're seeing how people do things socially. We see how we each handle stress, and our parents are great modelers. And those experiences set down circuits just like riding a bicycle in my mind. And once you learn them, they're hard to unlearn. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I talk a lot about the tapes that we all run in the back of our heads that we have from our own parents, what we learned, what we heard, how things were. And now the neuroscientists are really starting to trace those and to see the actual physiological impact of trauma, stress, child abuse on children's actual brains, and learning that these stress hormones that are created under these difficult situations cause changes in the children's brains that may lead to significant learning and behavioral and emotional difficulties over time.
Amanda, I talked with you briefly before we came on the program, and I hope it's fair to share that you were a foster child for a while, and I know June's been involved in the system. Does this idea of early parenting is the big umbrella term, but helping parents understand needs and how important early experiences are to children, anything that drives your experiences and what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I think when you guys said, you know, you can teach someone how to have a baby but not to do once you have a child, that certainly makes sense. And I think reflecting back on my own experience and thinking about the situation I grew up in, and I don't know what's different for me or why I turned out okay. At least I think I turned out okay. But I grew up in a situation with severe domestic violence, substance abuse, emotional abuse, not just emotional abuse, but then also neglect and not having my basic needs met. But I think, I don't know, somehow I pulled through that. I always did well in school, and I always just sort of cut off what was going on at home. But that affects, you know, all children in different ways. And I think how do we know, you know?
One of the really up-and-coming areas of research related to that is the gene-environment interaction. And there are lots of folks trying to look at how do some kids go through a certain situation and basically not show those kinds of long-term brain-based effects, while other kids can be in a less difficult but still stressful situation and have significant problems. And some of it does appear to be some level of genetic less vulnerability for some kids, but we don't know how to sort that out and how to define that early on.
Let me remind our listeners real quickly, because this is an area I'm interested in myself, 550-8433. If you've got comments, experiences, questions to any of our listeners, you can call us right now at 550-8433. Also, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email directly until 3 o'clock at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at ksk.org. Laura, expand on that idea. I mean, it makes sense to me to realize that you have individuals who go through unusually stressful situations. And it doesn't even have to be child abuse. It could be some other traumatic event like being in a war, in a refugee camp, or any number of things. And yet some individuals come through that less scathed than others. And you're saying that maybe genetics has something to do with it, or how the environment impacts on the genetics?
That is an up-and-coming area of research, is how does the environment affect the genetic predisposition to handle stress, to develop mental illness, to develop learning or behavioral issues. The interplay of the two, the old nature versus nurture argument, and realizing that it isn't a versus, it's a nature plus nurture, and how do those two things go together in any one individual? And we still don't really know that. You mentioned earlier the idea of temperament, which has a genetic base but is also somewhat different than genetics. We know that some kids are, the old term was the invulnerable child, the children who can go through all kinds of situations and always kind of bounce back. And other kids who have a different temperamental style, often called the difficult or strong-willed temperament, who are so much more quickly and easily gotten off track by just little minor upsets in the day or in their lives. As psychologists, we are still struggling to understand how do we know which are those kids and how do we best help the kids who are more vulnerable while still not neglecting the less vulnerable kids who are in difficult situations. And you're right, it is the same with the soldiers coming back from war situations. Some can go through very, very stressful situations and seem to do okay, while others are very seriously impacted. And unfortunately, we don't know yet a good way to identify ahead of time which ones will be which.
So what you can do is make the system that you've got as good as you can be. June, is the psychological aspects of things an important issue when you're dealing with volunteers? And are you looking at that in foster parents? And you're looking at that in the potential CASA volunteers and so forth?
In terms of looking at children and their psychological needs?
Just understanding the importance of psychology.
Definitely, because children who come into the system have already experienced significant trauma and abuse, and they haven't been safe where they've been living. And then the system comes in order to keep them safe, they remove them from there, which they should, because there are safety issues. But then that's an additional trauma for children, too, in terms of then they're losing their parents, they may lose their culture. There could be a number of siblings, and sometimes, unfortunately, siblings end up getting separated. So there's multiple losses that you can experience when the system is trying to keep you safe. And you move into a stranger's home, and you usually start in a new school. And if you move around a lot, you may end up with different teachers and different schools. And so that's something we're always mindful of and in trying to see what resources are in the community to help our youth and children.
You know, along with the temperament idea, which I always found is an excellent construct with which to talk to parents, in the sense that the child brings their own intensity of reaction, regularity of systems, adaptability to change, and so does the environment, the mom and dad. And although they may be the same offspring, there may be what's described a poor fit. It doesn't mean that, you know, I have a child, it may be exactly like me. We are not necessarily a good fit because we're both trying to be in control, for example, and we're both strong-willed and we're both intense reactors, and that's not so good. So it makes me think about even thinking about foster care. Is the fit good, and is there an analysis of how that fit may go, and if so, how does that happen? maybe we're not that sophisticated yet in this system, but I'm looking at ways and trying to push the envelope, I guess, and understanding that I think psychology is beginning to bring us a heck of a lot along the road of understanding what the needs are of these unfortunate kids who end up in the system for one reason or the other.
Well, one of the things that we've been advocating for is because we see children and youth who move around from foster home to foster home pretty frequently. The state just underwent a federal review of their child protection system, and I think it was 42% of children and youth in care move at least four times. But we've seen young people who've had – I'm a foster parent, and my youth who lives with me has had sort of 24th placement in 4 years. So that's a lot of moves. So, I mean, usually young people get taken into custody, but they just go into whatever home's available. There is no – matching program. There is no, you know, interview process. You just go to whatever's available. So you come out of this traumatic situation, you just get dropped off at a home with strangers. And that's your new life. So I was fortunate enough to be placed in a home where I had known the people, but it was still, everything was still different. I mean, my foster mom could cook the same meal as my mom cooked, but it never was going to taste the same. Things were always different, little things that are always different. And those are the kind of things that trigger children, too, when they're trying to adapt to a new environment. We've also been advocating to keep children in their same schools as they move throughout foster homes, so that way they at least still have the same social connections. They might have a teacher who understands the situation and can better work with them. So stability, I think, for children and youth in care is number one, but you're not always going to get matched with somebody that's going to work right off the bat.
Yeah, it would be difficult. I mean, from a medical standpoint, it's nice to have the same medical input and be able to keep track of the medical records. And so that stability is another part of that stability. Well, we have a caller. I think I'd like to go ahead and take that call right now. Is it Julie?
Yes.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a comment first and then a question, possibly a controversial question. My comment had to do with I just began listening to the program a few minutes ago when I got in the car. And no, I'm not driving right now. I was intrigued by the comment about research being done, new research being done on what is it that enables some children to survive horrifying circumstances while other children don't. And it reminded me that many years ago, Robert Coles, the psychiatrist Robert Coles, wrote a a book based on his extensive research called Children of Crisis. And in that book and in his research, he concluded that the single most common denominator of children who could survive horrifying circumstances, just indescribably horrifying circumstances, being raped, beaten, neglected, starved, et cetera, while their siblings even did not survive, was the influence of some other person, some other adult, whether it was a teacher or the postman or a neighbor or a grocery clerk, that it was some other contact. And I just wanted to throw out to people the name of that book, Children of Crisis, on that particular point. And then I had a question about, let me just state at the outset that I'm an attorney, I'm a former CASA myself, and a former foster parent. I'm also familiar with the Child Protective Services in another country. So my question reflects all of those things. I wondered if your guest or guests believe that there should be a shortening of the time period for biological parents, especially manifestly sadistic biological parents, shortening of the time period that they're allowed to get their act together and to convincingly demonstrate that they are really changed, so that children who keep being given back to such parents could be adopted out into stable families.
Okay. Seems like a reasonable question. And Julie, or June, it seems to relate to a comment you made before that things have changed within the system, that now there has to be a 120-day period, I think, is if I were saying this right, where there has to be some decision about what to do with a child. And you want to expand on the caller's question?
Well, I've been in the system, worked as a guardian ad litem and with the CASA program for a number of years, and one of the nice things that's happened is the federal government changed the time length of when you start looking at how long a child should be in the custody of the state, and they shortened up the time frames for that. I mean, we're given 120 days to figure out what the reasons are of why this child is in the custody of the state, and then we'll start looking at it every year about what's the permanency for this child. So they have shortened up the timelines. And we've also started looking at not only what the parents are doing, but what's happening with the child. What's in the best interest of the child? Is it in the best interest of the child to continue to be in the custody of the state while the parents are struggling to address their problems? So we're introducing the whole concept of what's best for this child and kind of getting the focus not only looking at what the parents are doing, but how the child is doing. And so I think that the laws have changed, and we're finding children lingering less in kind of limbo in foster care, that we are moving quicker toward permanency, which is clearly in the best interest of children.
Could I have a follow-up question?
Sure.
I understand that the time period has been shortened from what it was in the past, but could be wrong on this. But isn't it true, though, that still when a child is given back to the foster, to the biological parents, and then subsequently when the foster parents repeat that behavior or worse, then when the child comes back into the system, doesn't the time start to run all over again?
Not necessarily. No, it doesn't. You can look at the history.
There is now an absolute limit for how long the child can be in the system, even if the child is going back and going in and out of the system.
Yes, there is.
Oh, that's good to know. Good. Well, thank you for that.
Thanks for your call.
I'd also like to say wonderful things about Les Guerra's proposals in the legislature here.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Why don't we take another break? Let me let you know you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Support for Line 1 comes from Lake Otis Pharmacy, providing service to the community for over 20 years with prescription insurance, satellites, and medical equipment for your health care needs. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor. And support for Line 1 comes from Alaska USA with end-to-end solutions for home buyers, including mortgages, insurance, title, and escrow services. On the web at alaskausa.org.
This is Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're talking about child abuse. My guests are Laura Jones, a clinical psychologist. It's been in practice for several years in Anchorage. June Hastings, who is a program coordinator for the CASA program in the Office of Public Advocacy, and Amanda Mativier, who is the founder of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. Amanda, I'd like to get back with you. When I was listening to some of the comments just a moment ago about children, it sounds good to me that the children, or at least adolescents, are beginning to have some impact on the decision-making process. But that can also, like everything, be good and bad. In your experience, do you think children make the right decision regarding their care when they have the opportunity?
Well, I think that's case by case, again, sure, depending on that young person. And for the most part, I think our older youth know what they want. I think if they're asked where they want to live and they're placed there, then it's going to work out better than if they're placed somewhere they don't want to be, because a lot of times if they don't want to be somewhere, they're just going to run. So, and that adds to the problems.
Mm-hmm. As a person that's been involved in the foster care system, do you see the nature-nurture argument similarly as it's been described today, that there are children that clearly can handle this stress more successfully than others? And also, are there children that bring some of their own problems upon themselves?
Well, I certainly think there's going to be children that bring problems no matter what. I mean, I, as a teenager in foster care, brought plenty of problems to my foster family. Mm-hmm. But I think what it takes is people who are willing to stick with it. I had a caring, supportive family that, you know, no matter what I did and no matter how much trouble I caused, they didn't say, okay, it's time to move to a new home. They said, all right, you've got a court hearing. We're going to go with you and stick by you. So I think it's people who are willing to step up and treat children and youth in care as their own is what really makes a difference. Loving, supportive family, that's what really makes a difference. Knowing that you're cared about and knowing that someone has high expectations of you makes you want to do well. But if you have people who treat you as a foster child or treat you as, you know, a guest in their home, then that certainly adds to the feeling of, I guess, being uncomfortable already and everything that's happening. I think it just adds to making it worse.
Laura, you've implied that, or we've heard, I'm not sure necessarily it was you, that the older adolescent children, it may be harder on them in a foster care situation than in younger ones. Is that true, and why might that be? I would have guessed that it's tougher because of this impact on this plastic brain earlier in life, that you make some changes that are harder to change.
I think it has different effects at different ages. Certainly the kids under the age of 2.5 or 3 have a really tough time going into foster care because they don't have the language to understand what's going on to them. They often experience this incredible disruption and removal in their life, loss of everything familiar, and have no language to really understand why that's happening. In terms of brain effects, that is hugely disturbing and potentially very damaging for young kids. However, that said, we have many more families who are willing to take those kids on, and foster parents are often much more understanding of a toddler who is running around being kind of wild and aggressive and disruptive than they're going to respond to a 15-year-old because it, number one, seems developmentally more appropriate for the young child, but also because it's not scary. You know, you can handle a 2-year-old who's kind of out of control and wild, while watching a 15-year-old who's doing the same thing can be very intimidating to foster parents. I think what we were trying to imply earlier, though, is that it is harder to find homes that really want to stick with our adolescents, and that people seem to react more quickly to their behaviors as a sign that the fit is not good and that they should just be removed. And I think there's a lack of sensitivity of what that loss means to our older kids, that people see this as, oh, well, they'll just go someplace else and they'll be just fine. And often those losses are hugely traumatic to our older kids as well.
I'll remind our listeners once again, if you have questions or comments, 550-8433 is a local number. You can reach us till just before 3 o'clock today, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And email us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E at KSK.org. Amanda mentioned, I think it was Amanda, that multiple homes seems to have an additive, almost synergistic effect on bad outcomes. Is that kind of an experience that you have noticed as well, and why might that be?
This is a big topic of mine. Certainly, moving kids from home to home has a very deleterious effect on the kids. Kids who come out of a tough situation, again, often don't have very many coping skills. They've already experienced a lot of trauma. Then they experience the loss of being removed from home and family and everything familiar to be placed in a foster home. Each time they then get moved to a new foster home, it's another whole set of losses. The child may just begin to attach to the new foster family, not just to the parents, but to the other kids in the home, to the neighborhood, to the school, to all the things that are part of that, living in that family. And just as they start to attach, to have that changed again means a whole new set of losses. And clearly there's lots of research on attachment that shows that these additional losses are not just additive, but almost multiplicative. They continue to really increase the negative outcomes for kids. We were talking with the caller earlier about shortening up the timeline and not sending kids back home so frequently, and the focus now in the system of trying to look at the best interest of the child. And often one of the questions I'm asked to address in the court system is it in this child's best interest to stay where they are in a foster home, even though they're not biologically related, but they've become attached, they've formed relationships, they're thriving? Or should we move them now back to the biological family or to distant relatives of the family so that they maintain the blood connection? Is the blood connection more important than the psychological connections that the children have made? And I will say that I frequently am arguing that the psychological connection, once it is made, needs to be given huge importance in the child's life.
So stability...
Stability is important.
Wins out.
Usually.
Most of the time. Again, the individual is the point of view. You got to look at each situation.
Exactly.
So does the court system, June, understand this? And if so, why does it continue to happen? Or is it in getting better? Are we just taking it out of the frame of references that, yeah, there are people who've been in 24 different homes, but that's becoming less and less of an issue?
Well, I think we're more aware of it. And the efforts need to happen at the very beginning when a child or a youth is removed from the home to start identifying relatives, family members, church members, people in the community, someone that they know where they can go and be safe while their parents are addressing their issues. And with CASAs, that's the only family that they're working with, and we try to encourage them to immediately start looking for relatives, looking for tribal members, talking to tribes, talking to church members, just reaching out in the community, because if we can get the youth placed somewhere where it's not quite foster care, I mean, the person can be licensed, but it's somebody that knows that person, that youth or that child, I think the chances are much better that that's going to work, there's going to be that stability, and then also can kind of foster contact with the family, and I think that works better for children. And then so you're thinking about permanency for that youth from the very beginning, not 2 years down the road saying, okay, let's look to see what relatives are out there who can care for this child, but let's do it the very beginning of the case instead of waiting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You were shaking your head, Amanda, when June was saying that.
Yeah, I think identifying relatives up front, I mean, with the Indian Child Welfare Act, I mean, that's the law, but a lot of times children are taken into custody and they go into a foster home, and then there's this search for relatives later on down the road, and they have that attachment to the family. And
at first, you have to make this decision to make the child safe, so that's got to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's understood. But then you have to have the time to start looking around. How about foster families? What does it take to be a good foster family? How good are we at identifying good foster families?
I think it's very challenging to be a foster parent. One of the things that I do is when they're training foster parents, they have a panel and they invite social workers and guardian ad litems and CASA staff to come and talk to them. And I always thank foster parents because, you know, you're not only taking children into your home and youth into your home, you're inviting a licensed social worker into your home. You're inviting we have wraparound services for youth. You're inviting a lot of different adults into your home, and it's very challenging. It's very challenging to deal with the child protection system, and it can be very frustrating. And I think oftentimes while the foster parents have absolutely the best of intentions in wanting to care for children, once again, it's like being a parent and not having that book about how to take care of your children. You're trying to parent some children who have experienced a lot of trauma and a lot of grief and loss, and it's a tough job. It's a very tough job.
How easy is it to recruit foster parents? Is it constantly under-recruited? We don't have enough?
I hear often that the best way to recruit foster parents is happy foster parents. And I think right now there maybe aren't that many happy foster parents just because of support from, you know, the state and not just, I mean, financially, but support in getting children's basic needs met. Being a foster parent's tough. I thought for me it would be easy because I was in foster care and I understood this, but it's been quite the challenge, and there isn't a lot of support from the state side. But we actually just worked to get some money into the OCS operating budget, so there's going to be some TV, radio, media ads to start recruiting foster families. And so I think that's going to be a good way to reach out to the community and let people know that this is definitely a need.
When you say there's not enough support from the state, what are you talking about, financial support or more?
I think just basic needs, having basic needs met, because there's certain things that can't be done without, you know, the social worker's approval. And social workers are supposed to they come out monthly and do a home visit, and sometimes that doesn't always happen, or they're so overwhelmed, their caseloads are so high that they don't have, you know, the chance to call you back or get back to you and help you get, I mean, the child's needs met, so...
Just dawned on me, I think it would be nice if I was a foster parent that I would have a fairly quick and easy access to a child psychologist. Is that a pie in the sky? Yeah. Or is it it's a good idea, but A, it ain't going to happen.
It happens far too rarely.
Yeah.
We have certainly a number of people now available, at least in Anchorage, who know these issues, who work with kids, but... lots of foster families and foster kids don't get access to child psychology on even the most basic level. And unfortunately, we often get to see only the situations where things are way out of control. And again, too far down the road and not in that preventative mode where if the family and the child had help up front, things might go much more smoothly.
There really is a lack of resources in the community. When children and youth come into the custody of the state, Medicaid is available for therapy sessions. But it's been harder and harder to identify therapists who are able to take the Medicaid and for foster parents to be able to have somebody that can work with them with youth with challenging behaviors or children with challenging behaviors.
I'd like to say that, yeah, I mean, that gets back to our healthcare system, which I'm constantly reminding people needs a little bit of change, I think, at least. And it never made sense to me to give health insurance for medical problems and not psychological problems, when if you ask any primary care provider, 2/3 of everything they see in the office has got a psychological rationale. Either they're there because of the medical problem, but the psychological issues related to it, or it's a pure psychological problem in a medical office. And that's been shown over and over and over again. So, anyway.
Keep saying that, Pat.
So, I always like to ask about misconceptions. We've got several minutes at least here, five or so. What are misconceptions about child maltreatment that come to people's minds when I say, what's a misconception?
I can think one of the big misconceptions is that we're mostly talking child abuse, and I do want people to remember that we really are talking child neglect, and almost 2/3 of the situations that get addressed by the Office of Children's Services, we're talking about kids who are neglected, where parents have a lack of awareness of how to meet the child's developmental needs. And these are situations like leaving two-year-olds home alone while the parent goes to the store, or finding a two-year-old and a four-year-old wandering the halls of a local hotel because the parent has gone out to have a drink because, you know, after all, the children are asleep, so I can just go ahead and leave. And a whole variety of other kinds of neglect situations. But I think that we need much clearer education for folks on what kinds of supervision children need, what kind of feeding they need, what kind of medical care, psychological care they need.
Other thoughts or comments at all that come to mind? What do we need to do better? What is another idea? I mean, we've talked about a bunch of things. If you were the czar of child maltreatment and could have your druthers, Amanda, let's ask you. You've been in the system. What still needs to be done? I mean, I'm envious of someone as strong as yourself to go out and try to repair things and see an area that needs to be fixed. But what else still needs to be done?
I think there needs to be a lot more done in the areas of prevention, preserving families up front rather than even taking children into custody. I think working with families beforehand and helping them to, you know, take care of their children and become a secure, safe family and not waiting to that point where it gets so bad that children have to come into custody. But overall, I think if a child does have to come into custody, then really working toward placement stability and making sure that that child's life is disrupted as, I guess, as least as it possibly can be for that situation. And again, fostering those relationships with mentors and people who are going to be there for older teens beyond foster care. And I also think that's one of the great things about CASA, too, even though I know this isn't what they're supposed to be, but they do end up being those mentors and those people who are in these youth lives when they age out of foster care. They're the ones who go to their wedding and are there to watch them, you know, graduate from college and stick around. We have one of our members who I think is she's 22 now, and she hasn't talked to anyone who was ever on her case except for her CASA. And, you know, she said that this is somebody that she just was horrible to the first time she met her as a teenager, didn't want anything to do with her, but she just kept coming back and kept coming back, and so stuck with that. So I think fostering those relationships and identifying people who are going to be there and be caring and supportive.
Yeah, that was something that Julie, one of the callers, mentioned a little bit. I keep thinking about the word mentor, or somebody that just gets involved and cares and shows that they care and not just talks about it but follows through with actions is an important aspect of things. Well, we're really at the end of our hour. There was an email that came in, and I apologize for not being able to spend the time addressing that question. I want to thank you all very much for taking the time to come in today. It's helped me understand the system a lot better, and it reassures me a little bit about my understanding about child psychology, Laura, so I appreciate that as well. Next week, we're going to continue to talk about child abuse. I think we're going to be focusing a lot more on outcomes and what it means to be abused as a child and how that affects you and why it affects you as you grow older. My guests will be Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson and Josh Arvidson. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday, April 2nd at 2 p.m. It's April 6th. I almost said that wrong. At 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSK and for Line One, this is Dr. Thad Woodard.
This has been Line One, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at lineone@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.